another edition of Expanding Mind. I'm your host, Eric Davis, exploring the cultures of consciousness. This last weekend, I went to the Bioneers Festival, which I've been attending not every year, but most years since, gosh, must have been 1992, when it was called Seeds for Change and was held in Santa Fe, New Mexico, and has since grown into a very reliably inspiring gathering, environmentalists, indigenous leaders, permaculture figures, community organizers, and increasingly people of color and progressive political elements. And they, you know, they have their formula down, but it's a good one. And one of the things that the conference does is to inspire the people who are coming, because as many of you know, working on progressive or environmental issues, or really just trying to make it through our crazy world today with your heart open and your mind clear, it can be pretty discouraging sometimes. And one of the marvelous things about the Bioneers is, while it presents a good deal of information and certainly provides a marvelous place for people to meet and to find out what's going on, it also just creates a kind of utopian moment, or a sort of moment of sweetness and of enthusiasm that recharges people's batteries. And indeed, I think that's one of the things we really need at this point in world history, are places not only to sort of recharge our batteries, but really to model, in a sense, what a better society would be like, and to model it in terms of community organization, in terms of technical issues, in terms of living arrangements, in terms of political models, in terms of celebrations, relationships, etc. And on this show, we've spoken a number of times about how festivals, at least at their best, and they're not often or certainly always at their best, but festivals at their best can do this for people. You go to a festival and you come away with a sense of different kinds of human relations that are possible, different ways of tuning into your own capacities and your own emotional landscape, forms of gathering, forms of sharing, forms of living that perhaps require less of the consumer items that blanket us in our ordinary lives. But of course, the festival does not last. A much more challenging, but certainly more satisfying and influential form of the same kind of model is undertaken by communities, particularly alternative communities that construct themselves in part to be models, to be seen, to resonate with the larger cultural, social field, as well as working on all of the tremendous challenges that go on with forming new kinds of community. And I've been interested in communities for a very long time, although I've spent, unfortunately, very little time in them myself, other than visiting quite a number. And one that I've been hearing about for years now that fascinates me is called Tamara, and it is in Portugal. It started off originally in Germany in the late 70s and moved to Portugal, I believe, in the mid-90s onto 330 acres of land. And now there's about 170 people there, which is a goodly number, and it's a very long-running run for an alternative community, which means they're doing something right, probably many things right. You have to, in order to sustain these things. And one of the things they do is that we'll be talking about is to transform the land. I believe that Tamara, where some representatives were at Bioneers, partly because they're working on water restoration in particular, but really changing the whole relationship to the land as well as to the people within the community. And luckily today we'll be talking to someone from Tamara, and Martin Wieniecki is touring around because, as I mentioned, Tamara and their Peacework project are very much invested in sharing their information, in illuminating people as to the ways that they found to work through community and to inspire other people in various ways to create their own communities. And on the tail of this sort of evangelical mission to the world outside of the community boundaries, there's a new book by one of the founders of the community, Dieter Duhm, and it's called Terra Nova, Global Revolution and the Healing of Love. And for those of you listening to the show right now or within the next few days of recording it, you're welcome to go and get a copy of the Terra Nova ebook on donation. I'll just give you that URL right now. It's Verlag, Verlag-Mega, MEIGA.org/Terra Nova ebook. And there's dashes between Terra Nova and ebook. And so you can check it out yourself. But luckily, we can also just talk to Martin. So, Martin, welcome to Expanding Mind.
Thank you for having me. Good morning.
Yeah, absolutely. So, why don't you tell me a little bit about like who you are and what you are doing? I know you're doing an American tour right now. I think you are at Bioneers. You're going to other places. You're presenting information. What is this sort of raison d'être of this tour and your role in it?
I mean, I have come as a 16-year-old to Tamara. This was 9 years ago, and have kind of grown up for a good part there and been a student in the peace education that Tamara offered. And for the last years have been quite active in both education and network building in the community to kind of reach out and connect what we are doing in terms of this social and ecological experiment in Tamara with initiatives around the world, because there is clearly an awakening on this planet and a growing search for an alternative. And so with this tour, which has already been going on for more than 1.5 months now through the U.S., we've been in the East Coast, in different places, in different places in California, and we are now going up to Oregon. We feel that there is especially strong search also in the United States for new forms of life, for forms of recovering community, for restoring the land. And so we do this tour to share about our findings in this research, but also to connect with people who are interested in doing similar things and supporting such initiatives.
Wonderful. You know, I'd love to also, just before we get into more details on the community, just to tell your story a little bit. You know, 16 is a fairly young age to show up at a new kind of community. Do you mind just sort of sharing a little bit about where you were in your life, what you were looking for, what you were running from, where you were as a young person, and what you found, what kept you with Tamara? I'm sure there were very challenges, all sorts of challenges come up living in community, but you stuck with it and, you know, clearly making it your life and your identity. So I'd love to hear a little bit about where you were in your life that led you to the community.
Sure. I mean, I think I was I came to a point as a young person, like many young people come, at least in our Western societies, in this time, when there is this realization that something is fundamentally wrong with the society and the world that we are growing up in, and what we are told that this is how life is meant to be, this is the kind of career you're meant to have, and there was, in my early youth, there was just at some point an awakening where I saw what hides behind this term of globalization, and I suddenly understood also the educational path in my school and university that I was kind of guided to, how this is all in one line kind of putting myself in a place to serve a society which is so strongly in contradiction with the basic principles of life and love and nature. And I was quite shaken and was looking and going to many groups trying to find answers. And I was in my hometown in Eastern Germany where I grew up. I was very active in the in different anti-capitalist and also anti-fascist groups. And I saw that this political fight alone, raising the fist, this kind of harsh struggle against the existing structures, that this wouldn't be sustainable. It was so tough. And so when I found Tamara, it was really something new for me that I found a place where it is very radical in its intention and core to change everything, to really reimagine and redesign the very basics of our human life on this planet, but at the same time doing it in a way where it is not. Where it is not in a, in a sense of fighting, but really trying to see what is a form of human coexistence that generates trust between people. And this combination was very attractive to me. And especially when I got there, I first came for an education time. My parents were quite afraid and it needed some time to get to know the project and finally see that it's not a cult or anything like this, what they feared. And it was a big and still is a big experience to explore what it means to relearn community with people, to step out of this kind of private form of life, this isolated form of ego existence, and to really step into a way where I'm transparent with my life and I'm seen, I'm mirrored by the others, and I lead a form of life that is guided by solidarity and mutual support. This is as a basis. This was kind of the first kind of learning I took in the community before specializing then in a special department or profession in building this larger and more holistic model that we are trying to create with the ecology and the technology and all those different parts.
Yeah, and then just one more kind of bit on your life, because I think it's always important to hear individual stories, even if the ultimate story is about forming new kinds of collectives, new ways of being in community. When, as I said, I mean any kind of shift that's as radical as moving into a society, even a very attractive society that is built on trust and transparency and free sexuality, which we'll talk about later, and different models of how to be that are in many ways very appealing because we are locked in our egos. We're locked in this kind of modernist way of being and occupying space and being in relationship that are clearly profoundly dysfunctional. That said, it's also difficult to make these kinds of transitions. Everything comes up. Everything is resisting all your fears, etc. When, especially in the first years of your experience with Tamara, when I'm just presuming difficult things came up, maybe sometimes you wanted to leave or maybe not, but I'm sort of curious what it was, what was the main thing about the community or about being there that kept you going forward, that enabled you to, you know, integrate yourself more and more into, you know, what is still a very radical kind of experience. That kind of transparency, that kind of openness to mm-hmm. so many other people is quite shocking for people, even people who want it. So what kept you kind of going, especially in your early years?
It's really a couple of things. One thing is this constant work on the inner transformation, on kind of not accepting the structures of fear, of mistrust, the structures of ignorance, all of this, and where the people, also the ones who had been in this community for nearly 40 years, they were not. I never saw people who were kind of done and said, okay, I've reached now a stage where I'm kind of settled, but it's this constant kind of attempt to really make this transformation and the sense of trust and solidarity this makes possible when people show themselves in their really on a deep level, also in their conflicts and fears, and where this encounter is possible on a level of non-judgment. This experience of also of seeing how the community, how people react when I myself stepped into this kind of revelation in points where I would think before, if they know this about me, you know, things I would never tell to others usually, then they would probably send me out. And the experience again and again was that in the place I'm really authentic, what comes back to me is support, is appreciation, and sometimes even love. So this was one very strong thing, this constant experience of trust building that is happening as a basis for the social work on community. But another point was also this this political aspect in creating not only a nice niche for these 170 people living there, not only for our surrounding in the region, but really this constant question driving the community: how can we establish an alternative to this disastrous system of global capitalism? What is the shift that we can make that has an impact on the planet? And for me, it was really these two things: this going deep into restoring honesty and trust in the human relations, and the establishment and the work on an answer to this unimaginable violence on this planet. These two things kept me there, and the authenticity with which the people there were carrying out this work.
Yeah, I mean, it was really wonderful reading Dieter's book. I found it quite engaging, even if parts of it don't necessarily exactly jibe with how I see things. I probably am, unfortunately, a bit more pessimistic about many things in human society and human nature. That said, I found it a very compelling vision, and I particularly like what you had mentioned about how even the people who had been around the community for 40 years had not sort of found themselves at some place of perfection where they were then kind of you know, lording it over everyone else or being the sort of figureheads. And you can really tell the way that there's a sort of self-questioning or a constant moving forward and a recognition of difficulties and challenges in the way that Dieter talks about it. And I think it's also important to remember, I mean, as obviously to for our listeners, that he was of extremely active in the radical movement in Germany in the late 60s, and was part of a variety of radical political movements, but in a way similar to you, also found that without improving or integrating psychologically as communities, that these groups tended to reproduce, sometimes even with greater degrees of ferocity, the sort of ambient illnesses of society, and that's why, in order to make larger political change for him, it also required radical experiments in community. So at no point was it ever a sort of let's go off survivalist and make our little utopia and be as disconnected from the rest of the world as possible. It was always motivated by a larger kind of vision. There's a lot of consequences of that and ways of thinking about it. But, you know, one thing I'd like to ask about right now, just to give us a little bit more sense of what the community does, where its work is taking place, is to talk a little bit about the ecological things that are of such focus there, the water restoration, experiments with forms of energy, and a little bit of the kind of practical side of the vision that's being created for how smaller communities could survive in a kind of post industrial or post whatever global capitalism world.
Yeah, I mean, this is an important part alongside the social work of the work of establishing trust among people. It's really the work on a new relation to nature. So it's not only about implementing new ecological technologies and so, but it's really about the question, what is a healing relation of mankind with nature as a foundation for a new society? And there we see that the whole civilization that we have now has had a relation to nature that has been built on exploitation rather than collaboration. And so this has led to the manifold environmental crises that we see now, and we are trying to establish on a small scale in a model what a form of life could look like where this is fully turned, where we as human beings collaborate with nature and on this basis establish our systems of autonomy and self-sufficiency. And one very essential part in this has been working out a new relation to water, which is, it's the basis of our life. Our bodies consist to 70% of water, and it is the essential vital element of nature. And we, for the last 8 years, have established something that we call a water retention landscape. And in Portugal, we live in a region that has a very similar ecological situation like here in California, similar form of rainfall, a similar form of ecological destruction and desertification. And the region seemed to be becoming a desert within 15 or 25 years. This is what scientists there say. And over the last 8 years, in creating this water retention landscape, we could show that this is not what the future has to be, but it is in fact possible to restore the landscape into a lush place with a lot of water, with a lot of biodiversity, and of course, food self-sufficiency. And essentially, this was because, I shortly explained this, that through the mismanagement of the environment, through the destruction of the forests, through the overuse of land, through monocultures and so on, what happened is that in most places on Earth, 90 places of the land areas, the topsoil was lost. It was lost in erosion that resulted from these destructive ways of dealing with nature. And thereby the rainwater that falls on a land could no longer be absorbed in the ground. It could no longer be absorbed by the aquifers. And so what happened when the rain fell is that it was washed down. It took the fertile soil with it. It created erosion. It created damages when it came together in big streams and floods. And it rushed into the sea. And then in the times when there is no rainfall, you have dryness. You have and so in Portugal, we have a lot of water in the winter and no water in the summer. And the land dries out. The trees die in massive scales because they simply have no water anymore. And so what the water retention landscape does is to create water spaces that allow the rainwater to be kept on the land where it falls and to slowly sink into the ground. So we built water retention spaces, smaller lakes in the valley where the water usually rushes out, and a whole cascade of such lakes that allow the aquifers to be filled again. And the response of nature to this has been amazing. I mean, in the first year that the first water retention space was built, a spring popped out near to it, flowing all throughout the year again, supplying nature with a constant flow of water. Wildlife has returned. The trees that were planted around these lakes grow with such a power and speed. And so it gave us a lot of hope in seeing that it, in fact it can be possible to repair the damage that we have done to nature, even in quite a short time, because there is an immense potential of regeneration in nature. And our task as humans is to see this again and to collaborate with this ability of nature.
Yeah, it's all, these words are all very resonant for me because I'm a Californian, and as you can see in your journey through the state, that you know many of these issues are extremely pressing these days, and even as we look at the towards the El Nino coming this winter, that there's a lot of concern, of course, that because of the dryness of the soil and the status of the tops of the sort of layers on top, that we're just going to lose more water going out into the sea because the land isn't able to retain it because of the heat and dryness. So all the things you're saying, and I watched some videos on YouTube about your water restoration program, and you know you can see the before and after pictures and such, and it's really you know quite remarkable, and you know, and also seems very clearly creates a kind of it's a sort of almost a you know kind of holographic activity. You're working on the level of the land and working on the level of nature, but in order to do that, you're moving into an integrated worldview that also reflects social and spiritual ideas that that operate in the community. How are the sort of this sort of decisions made around something like, well, let's go with this approach rather than this approach. Let's, you know, how do we organize people in order to, you know, dig the wells or whatever the processes are? How are these kinds of decision-making, collective decision-making things that happen, particularly around really concrete issues? I mean, you guys use the phrase concrete utopia in some ways to talk about what you're doing. So there's very much an emphasis on needing to make it concrete. And so how are some of those political decision-making things worked out in ways that speak to your larger vision?
I mean, people always ask us this question in the hope that we put out a method that could simply be replicated in other places, and it's hard to give a straight answer to this because a lot of the decision making falls on the ground of this interpersonal work of kind of clearing the let's say the emotional substratum from fear, from jealousy, from competition, comparison. All these things that are usually teeming in the like kind of under the carpet of communities. And maybe when I just go back also to what you told about the founder, Dieter Doom, who was very engaged in the political movement, one of the reasons why he created the community was that he looked into all the hundreds of communes that were created in the 60s and 70s in Germany, very similar to what happened here in California, and how all these communities collapsed. He saw that it was due to their inability to establish answers to these interpersonal conflicts, predominantly around sex, love, money, and power. So and something that this community has been kind of built on, and without which it would probably not exist anymore, was the work on making the things which are usually not spoken in the interpersonal coexistence, to make these things transparent and to kind of reveal these interpersonal things in a way that real solidarity and trust can be developed. So we have also a forum that we work with, we call it Forum, and where it's really about clearing out the things that come in between people. Because oftentimes when we go about making decisions about very concrete things, about digging a well in a place, as you ask, so often discussions about such matters are not led really on the basis where people kind of coherently look at issues, but they are much more busy with, say, there are two ecological experts, for example, two strong men. In many cases, they are more busy with the competition between each other than with the actual matter that they are speaking about. And so in order to make decisions and work together in a way that it creates lasting trust, we have to look at the underlying issues rather than trying to find a sophisticated methodology that allows us to make decisions nevertheless. And our experience has been that when we are able to kind of bring out the underlying topics and work with them in a way that truth can be spoken between people and solidarity established, then it is actually, like, it's not that we have to work a lot with kind of making the decisions, but often when we communicate long enough and listen long enough, not only to each other but also to the land, the right decision emerges. We see it together. It's the result of the coherence we built between one another, and also with the vision that we are working towards. So we have this orientation that we want to create something what we call a healing biotope, a holistic model where all the relations between people and animals, between all living beings inhabiting, sentient beings inhabiting this place, are built on trust and solidarity. And so this vision guides us, and it's kind of like a magnet that allows us to walk on this path.
That's wonderfully said. Yeah, and there's, you know, a lot more I want to ask you about, but we're going to take a break right now. I also want to remind people that if you're listening to this today on Thursday, the 22nd, or the next couple of days, you can go to verlag-mega, verlag-meiga.org/Terra Nova ebook with dashes between those words, and you can get a copy of Dieter Duhm's Terra Nova. But we'll be right back after these messages to talk to Martin some more.
Capocante, host of The Vinyl Experience, and you're listening to PRN, your source for the best in progressive conversation, news, and entertainment.
Ladies and gentlemen, I'd like to invite you to listen to Warrior Connection on the Progressive Radio Network. Progressive Radio Network is moving forward, and we're doing the best we can for the veterans of our nation. Warrior Connection is an ongoing discussion with veterans, scientists, politicians, journalists, reporters, and doctors about the health and environmental effects of war on our nation's veterans. Our purpose is to provide the information necessary for all veterans to lead a productive life. Thank you very much, and God bless America.
Hi there, this is Harvey Wasserman. I am the host of the Solartopia Green Power Wellness Show, which airs every Monday at 3 p.m. at PRN.FM. We cover the great issues of your health and wellness, of the health and wellness of the planet, of moving ahead towards a Solartopian, green-powered, holistic Earth. Progressive Radio Network is moving forward, and we hope you're coming with us.
Stay tuned to PRN, your source for the best in progressive radio.
Welcome back to Expanding Mind on the Progressive Radio Network. We're talking to Martin Wieniecki about the Terra Nova community and healing biotopes. One of the things that came through both the Dieter's book and Terra Nova and your own discussion today is this: the role of trust as sort of in a lot of ways the one of the most central elements in order to have the kind of functioning community that can not only deal with the inevitable conflicts and to start modeling more healthy and integrated ways of being, but also, as you pointed out, clear the space for the right answers to emerge. I thought that was a very interesting response when I asked you about the political mechanisms, if you will, that the community uses. And the sense that I'm getting from you and from the book as well is that there really is a faith, if you will, that by clearing out the emotional situations and by being transparent emotionally and being open about the conflicts and jealousies and issues that inevitably come up between people, that space is made for solutions to emerge and that they are not necessarily engineered by the system of your political decision making or whatever, but that there's a kind of trust, if you will, not only among the people, but trust that if you stick to the path of trust, that answers will emerge, even very technical answers that require a lot of rationality, etc. So this question about trust is really striking. And as is pointed out in the book, one of the main things that comes up in communities are issues around sex and love and partnership and jealousy and lies and that whole very, cluster of human conditions that everybody listening to this show from wherever point of view they come from will be very familiar with. And my impression is that as Dieter saw that this was, along with his cohorts, that this was really one of the main issues to be cleared of for a working society, and that became some of the principal elements of their initial experiment in the late 70s, opening up to an intelligent version of free sexuality as something processed and practiced within a community of trust. And that has become a very important and indeed central part of Tamara's work. I'd love to hear a little bit more about that, and also even again speaking personally as someone brought up in the same society of sort of lies and subterfuge and hidden desires and jealousies as everybody else. How you yourself made this kind of transition into this world of trust, and particularly around issues of sex and love?
Yeah, that's a big question that we could speak about for a long time. The first thing I want to say is really that the introduction of what is sometimes called free sexuality, that it was from a place of an ethical imperative. And not so much, just to unleash all the bottled up life energies inside people, but that it was this insight that the founders had in the beginning of the project, where they saw if we really want to free our human interaction, our human coexistence, from lies, from deceit, from hypocrisy, which is the basis for anger and rage and many of the reasons that make both relationships and communities fall apart, we have to become truthful in the area of love and sexuality, because we that come out of this Judeo-Christian Western societies, we come out of a cultural tradition where hypocrisy was kind of deeply imprinted into the DNA of our culture. The suppression of sexuality has been an essential part for making people governable within these systems of injustice and oppression, which were historically built and which are still continuing in this capitalist system. And so many aspects of our erotic nature were suppressed and kind of forced in a very narrow system of what is socially acceptable in sexuality and love. And so, for example, there is in many people, there is a longing for erotic self-expression that goes way beyond what is acceptable in relationships. And you have so many loves that break apart because it is not possible to communicate this truthfully. There is so much of lying, so much of deceit in partnerships. And so the introduction of what they called free sexuality was to create a system of transparency where people are not forced to a certain, you know, to have sex with many people, but rather that it is a space that allows the one's sexual choice to be made transparent and for people to find and articulate what they really desire and where this is accepted again. It is really a research, for example, to create trust in this realm and to create a space of truth that allows lovers to really develop trust between one another, because coming out of this history, there is a deep fear of loss in virtually everybody. It is so deep and so universal that sometimes we don't even recognize it anymore, because it is so much part of our cultural DNA. And this fear becomes especially activated the more you come close to your longings. And so this whole area of love and sexuality is so deeply imprinted by fear. And so it takes a lot of trust building. And one of the things that they also saw was that this is not a task that you can leave up to two people privately. When you enter into these conflicts around love in a relationship, two people carry a topic which is historic, which is global, which is collective, and therefore it needs work on a collective level to really restore trust. And so it is a work really in this communal sense of making these things transparent. Working, studying a lot about the history we are coming from, and of course also of experimenting. How can we kind of fulfill both parts of the longing, which is on one side one for deep intimacy and commitment with a person or maybe also several, and on the other hand there is a free longing, a longing for eros on a much more universal level. And so this is kind of the experiment to bring these two things together and then to realize that they are not mutually contradictory, but rather complementary. And so now also personally speaking, for me, it was really incredible to kind of come into a community where there is this sense of acceptance for eros itself, where there is no, because in our culture there is such a sense of needing to hide who I am in this area. This is like, in order to be a good boy in school, to be in family, to be anywhere, this is the first thing I have to hide, my erotic being, and to grow up in a place where there is so much acceptance for it, to kind of show this and to reveal this. It has been, it's almost unspeakable what this does to a person, and of course it is a journey that brings up a lot of turbulence, but in a way I can also say that I wouldn't want to live in another way, because it is there is so much beauty in seeing what emerges when people come together on a level where they dare again to articulate and follow their true longings.
Well, one of the things that, of course, comes up in this sort of discussion emerges, and we've had it on this show a number of times, talking to various people about polyamory or sex positive lifestyles, is, of course, the issue of jealousy. And one of the interesting things about jealousy, of course, is that it's an open question. Whether, you know, how essential it is to human psychology. I mean, we can say that negative emotions like anger or possibly despair are sort of woven into our makeup, whether or not we act on them, whether or not we transform them. We can see that in the, you know, animal community, there's something like anger, there's something like despondency, the whatever, that these are part of our makeup. It's not so clear about jealousy, exactly how essential that is, even for the sort of person who's yet to begin psychological work, et cetera. And yet many, many people think of it, have a concept in their head that jealousy is sort of written into necessity, and that therefore, you know, monogamy is sort of the natural kind of form, because of course there is jealousy, and how could you hurt your partner, et cetera, et cetera. Obviously, that's not going to be the story or the way of talking about these things that you're working with in Tamara. So what is the sort of teaching on jealousy, or how do you deal with the jealousies that inevitably arise, at least for people who are beginning this work? In the context of community, I mean, I'm almost kind of curious to see, like, at what point does it become a sort of shared social reality? As if, you know, I'm sitting here, I'm a private person. I mean, in the sense that I have an inside that I don't have to speak or share with anybody, and I'm feeling terrible jealousy. I'm not really sure what to do about it. It's disrupting my ability to work, and it's bubbling it beneath the carpet, as you said. How, in terms of the whether it's the forum or other sorts of opportunities, are there for people to work through and transform those feelings?
I mean, first of all, I want to say that I think it's really one of our cultural diseases to really believe that jealousy is a part of love, because when you imagine the state of life which you're in when you are in love, you know, this feeling of where you could embrace the whole world, where you love not only the person you love, but where you have this openness and this state of being able to connect with life around you. And when you compare this openness and this also this readiness to help others, to serve, which I consider love, when you compare this state of being with the state of being when you are jealous, you know, the kind of this raging insanity and the readiness to destroy things and all of this, I think these two states of beings couldn't be more different from one another. And so to think that jealousy is a part of love, this is really part of this historical conditioning of the schizophrenia that our culture has kind of imprinted in this area. So Sabine Lichtenfels, one of the co-founders of Tamara, she always humorously says, jealousy belongs as much to love as asthma belongs to breathing. You know, and so this is kind of the approach we also have in our social practice to it. So when people are jealous, they are not judged. It is okay. It is part of the transition to have such feelings, but you have to know that it's a disease that you have to work on. So this is kind of a bit of the mentality. And of course, I also want to say that we are so conditioned to, you know, when we hear about kind of openness and sexuality, things that go beyond this kind of monogamy framework, just as the first imagination. But then, you know, there is this fear coming up of thinking everybody must be jealous. And I also want to say that this is not, when you live in a community where people can really develop trust between one another. This is not the reality. There are women who are who can maintain a deep friendship even though they know and they are open about loving the same man and the other way around. So there are many of these experiences. And still, of course, touching on all the kind of historical sediments we carry inside ourselves, one comes to places of jealousy also. And there, it is really, kind of an inner work of seeing how do I find back to my own kind of center. Because oftentimes when jealousy surfaces, it is already the point when one has kind of left one's own center. And then the work of the forum, again, is very important. That is this place of creating transparency where we can also give expression to things that are really explosive inside ourselves. And oftentimes being seen in these conflicts, it also creates a transformation.
Can you explain how the forum's set up? Like, what is it? Does everybody? I mean, do you have 170 people? Is it a smaller portion of them? Does everybody gather? Is there a center where someone stands? I would just love to hear a little bit about the process.
Yeah, it is something that we do on a daily basis. Sometimes also with 170 people, but more often it's smaller groups, maybe of 30, 40, 50 people. People that also live together on a day-to-day basis. And it is a space that is held by usually the most trusted people in the community, people that have themselves worked through the most in their of their inner structures and therefore know the most about all these issues of community. And so the forum is really a place where somebody can step into the center and the facilitator who holds the space takes care that there is really this free place for the person to bring out what is alive in them. And so the people who sit around, they are not interrupting in the performance, but the facilitator is the only one who can kind of give hints and support if he or she feels that this is needed in order to come to this place of truth. And what we also do oftentimes is artistic expression. So when I'm angry, I don't go in and say, I'm so angry at this person and doing this very, trying still to be kind of polite, but to really show what is alive. And oftentimes this needs it's almost like a theater performance to bring out what is happening. And there's always this kind of magical effect that in the place where people really hit this layer of authenticity, and be it you know, when you perform with a funny accent as a theater play about an angry fit you have, when you come into this place and this is witnessed by so many people, a transformation happens where it's almost like stepping aside and seeing myself in the role and in the pattern that I'm in. And through this, through the consciousness that I gain about this state that I'm in, a correction happens almost by itself. And the other part that is very important is that people are, like, when I sit down after my performance, people, my companions, my friends, step into the center and they give reflections on witnesses on what they saw. So this helps me also reflect on what I presented, and so this is where we practice also to be mutually supportive with one another, and this and also to say really what we think about each other. This form of feedback is so important because all of life, all living systems in nature, they work because there is constant feedback between all the different parts, and in our culture, this has been so diminished, and so feedback is really a basis for healthy development in the social and ecological and all the different realms of community. So we practice this in order to learn to give it in a way of solidarity.
Yeah, thank you so much for that. You know, I've studied, you know, histories of communes and collectives, and all the ones that seemed cool, whether or not they lasted long, but especially the ones that did manage to hold on, they always have some form of this, and it always seemed that the design of it, or the spirit behind it, or the kind of worldview implied by this particular need to have a place for transparency, for trust, but also for the airing of challenges, both between people and within people, that it's really, in a lot of ways, the, you know, at least one of the major keys. And so I really appreciate you explaining that. We only have another couple of minutes, so I wanted just to let you say a little bit more about what this expedition you're on right now is attempting to do in terms of hooking up other communities, or the way in which you see Tamara interacting with the rest of the world. And again, we just have a couple minutes.
Yeah. I mean, I want to say also that all this work that I described now on the ecological level, on the social level, on the sexual level, that it's the work on manifesting a vision for a future without war, a global peace plan, which we call the Healing Biotopes Plan, which attempts to kind of tip this global field of violence and war by creating a few small-scale, highly complex model centers for a nonviolent form of existence, and thereby introducing a new field on this planet. And so traveling in the U.S., we feel that there is a lot of readiness for people to jump into something radically new, and where there is also a growing resonance to this. And so this is kind of the attempt of this travel, of bringing out this book, but also something I would like to mention. We've just launched in the last days the Grace Foundation America, which is a foundation for humanizing money and to channel financial resources into the establishment of such centers, into Tamara, but also of other projects around the world that take on this kind of vision and task. And so this is really also an invitation to all the listeners to look at the book Terra Nova that we've just launched, and to collaborate, because it's not only a single project that will create a shift on this planet, but it will be an emerging network for a new culture that can more and more articulate and work towards a common vision for the world we want to create.
That's wonderful, Martin. I think we're going to have to end it there. Thank you so much for joining us on Expanding Mind.
Thank you very much for your questions. Enjoyed the conversation.
Great. And for all you out there, next week, tune in. We're going to be speaking to Peter Gray, witch author, about his new book, Lucifer, Principe. It's a little Halloween show. And remember, keep your minds open.